Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our first Senate Occasional Lecture for 2012. Today we're going to hear about a story of political upheaval, global financial crisis, internal party turmoil. Yes, it's the 1930s. Following that, through a time of splintering of parties and the formation of new parties, Prime Minister Joseph Lyons emerged as the victor. To talk about that time today, I'm very pleased that we have Anne Henderson with us to give us our lecture. She's the Deputy Director of the Sydney Institute, which is a highly regarded public affairs forum and think tank. She's a very well-known author and editor, commentator, and she's written an impressive collection of non-fiction works, including some biographies of some very strong and dedicated women. But she's also turned her hand to political biography and published a biography of Dame Enid Lyons, the first female member of the House of Representatives, in 2008. And last year, Dame Enid was joined with a biography of her husband, Joseph Lyons, who was our 14th Prime Minister. So I'd like you to join me in welcoming Anne Henderson to give today's lecture. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the invite, and thanks, Rosemary, and thanks to David, who was the initial inviter. Yes, what a time to be in Parliament House, Canberra, speaking about dysfunction in politics, which is probably much of what I'll be talking about today, even though the man in question was not a dysfunctional Prime Minister or Premier. In fact, he was very much a very able administrator, something I think able administration is something I think the Labor Party's having a wrangle about right now. But there are, you know, things don't change. It's not new to have this drama, as we're seeing on our television screens today. And narcissism and ego are very much part of the political dynamic, as they were through 1930 and 1931. And this was, in those days, as today, to the detriment of Labor. Now, it's true, Labor's had more splits than the other side of politics, probably because the party's been older, but also because the party's been ideological. I think what Rodney Cavalier has said in the last couple of days, what's both interesting and sad about this dispute is it's not over ideology, it's over personality, and that makes it a different kind of moment. But back in the 1930-31 period, the narcissistic spanner in the works was New South Wales Premier Jack Lang, who had eventually split the Labor Party in January 1931 with his Lang Labor supporters in the Federal Caucus. He forced the Scullin into a sort of minority government for the rest of that year, and that particular group of Lang Labor eventually managed to bring down the Scullin government in late November of 1931. And of course, after he had split the party, and prior to that, Joseph Lyons, who'd been the acting treasurer when Scullin went to the Imperial Conference in August 1930 for 5 months, which is an amazing thing to imagine a Prime Minister doing today. Joseph Lyons was acting treasurer, but he gave back his portfolio, and Ted Theodore was reinstated in January. And this also caused a problem, and I'll go into that in a moment. So had there been 24-hour news coverage of a visual kind, with every Tom, Dick and Harry being able to have a say on Twitter or social media, voters would have suffered little but saturation political commentary for most of 1931, if not half of 1930. But I should say at the outset, on a completely different matter, the subject of my talk today was not entirely enamoured by upper houses in his early political career, or certainly his political career until he joined the Conservatives. Upper houses had been a thorn in his side, partly because a lot of upper houses in those times were Conservative. And as a Labor Premier of Tasmania, he'd stood up to the Legislative Council on more than one occasion in the 1920s when he was Premier, over its financial powers, which had lasted, traditions which had lasted from the 19th century. And on a couple of occasions, he'd even managed to bypass the upper house with the help of the governor, which is probably something that some leaders of governments would quite enjoy doing today. How many prime ministers would? He'd also faced a very conservative Senate during his years in the Scullin government, which was from late 29 until he resigned in 1931. There wasn't, I think, proportional representation in those days, and the Senate through the years of Scullin and for a fair distance after, was heavily weighted to the Nationalists and later the United Australia Party. But then Joseph Lyons moved to the Conservatives in 1931, and thereafter upper houses became more to his liking. Now, I'm here to discuss one of Australia's longest serving and most popular prime ministers. And yet it's taken some 70 years for anyone to write his proper biography. There have been books written where he's been included, such as Kate White's book on him, he and Enid Lyons' political love story. There have been PhD theses done, such as Philip Hart's PhD thesis back in the 1960s, which, am I better there? Philip Hart's PhD thesis I was indebted to because he managed to get to the story of Staniforth Ricketson and J.B. Weir and Sons and the Group of Six who were instrumental in bringing Joe Lyons over to the Conservatives. So there'd been work done on Lyons, but no one had seen fit to write a biography, which is quite extraordinary because the Lyons story is rich in anecdotes and happenings and all sorts of things. So he's been sort of shoved off into some region of forgetfulness. If you go into your general history books, you'll find a lot about the Scullin government, a lot about Labor and the Depression. Then you'll hop over to a bit of Menzies and lots of Curtin and the World War. It's almost as if he achieved little or nothing except he won some elections. And that legacy has stalked the memory of J.A. Lyons, as he was wont to sign on his official documents, and given the impression it was a whole period when we just went to sleep. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. The problem partly is that he died in office in 1939, not having completed his third term as a Prime Minister, and was leader of a party by then, the United Australia Party, which had lost much of its talent and become very divided, and left his legacy to be taken on by what was left of the United Australia Party in the form of Robert Menzies, who then managed a couple of years as Prime Minister, won an election barely, and was forced to resign in 1941, handing over to a Labor government led by John Curtin. And finally, being soundly defeated in 1943, the United Australia Party, the election, ironically, where Enid Lyons won her seat in the House of Representatives as a member of the UAP. But that legacy faded because when the Conservatives again became strong, Menzies had created, with others, had created the Liberal Party, and the Liberal Party went on after 1949 to an unparalleled length in office, and Menzies and the Liberal Party began their own tradition. They were Lyons' rivals, in a sense. On the other side of politics, Labor thought he was a rat, he'd left the party, and the irony is that it wasn't Joe Lyons who split the party, it was Jack Lang. And yet Lang went into the folk history as one of Labor's men of significance, and Lyons was left to be punished for having gone to the Conservatives. Now, Joe Lyons served Australia as Prime Minister from January 1932. That was because he won the election a few days before Christmas in 1931, and everyone went home to have Christmas dinner and New Year celebrations, and then they came back to Canberra on the 7th of January to swear themselves in. So from the beginning of 1932 until he died in office on April the 7th, which was also Good Friday of 1939. In that period of time, but before I go on to that, the other thing to notice about Joe Lyons was he was the first Australian Prime Minister to have a parent born in Australia. I worked that out as I was digging through the files, which tells you a lot about how imported our Anglo-Australian culture is. So when Joe Lyons became Prime Minister in 1932, we'd only been a federation for a little over a few decades, for 30 years. And one of the reasons Jack Lang assumed such importance was because at that time, New South Wales was a huge economic chunk of the federation we called Australia, with an economy something on the same size as the federal government's. And when Joe Lyons, as one of his first acts as Prime Minister, brought down the Lang presence in New South Wales, sacked by the governor, but because of cautionary discipline from the federal government under Joe Lyons, defeating Lang, as some writers have said, was possibly Joseph Lyons' greatest feat. Now, Lyons was a different kind of leader for his day, and that's the other reason why I think he's been forgotten. unlike our present leaders, he was inclined to defer praise to others, not to always put himself forward as the one who made everything happen. This was something I think he'd learned from childhood, from a fairly austere background, maybe a bit of his Catholic cultural teaching, put yourself back, be humble, whatever, and the fact that he'd had to work from humble circumstances, his father having lost his business through gambling when Joe was about nine, forcing Joe to work part-time and continue his studies only if he was lucky, and only to continue his studies eventually because a couple of maiden aunts saw that he did. And he worked his way up as a monitor teacher and then got into politics through disputes with the education department. He was, like Bob Hawke, a consensus man, and not this was not understood so readily at a time when the macho figure of the paternalistic male was very much the idea of strength in leadership. And yet this man, this unassuming, likeable, affable man of the people who had walked from Labor to the Conservatives, took Australia through some of its darkest years. And he managed to keep the government united, and that's probably because he was one of these figures who believed in consensus. But in deferring praise to others or to not pushing himself in to the front and always talking himself up and then dying and not writing his memoirs, he's left himself in a bit of a shadow. Douglas Irvine, who's a very well-known journalist and who worked as Lyon's chief of staff and media man and was one of the strengths of the Lyon's years, once said in an interview many years after Lyon's death that he would often deflect the praise to his mates, one of whom was in the early days John Latham. John Latham went on to be Chief Justice, and John Latham was the national figure leader who gave his position to Joe Lyon's in 1931. And Irvine added, Latham would swell with pride. And it was people like John Latham and some of those Conservatives who also added to the legacy of Lyons that he was always a nice chap, but we had to sort of help him through. We had to sort of teach him the way. Ha ha. That's what they thought. So it suited his rivals and it suited his enemies to put Joe down, and that's been going on for 70 years. But in fact, Lyons was very good at directing. We have the producer, we have the director of movies, and we have the star. Sometimes the Prime Minister's the star, sometimes the Prime Minister's much better director. And that's what Joe Lyons was. He was very good at the podium. He was very good at doing the right things that appeared in front of people to win the votes. He was very good at winning elections, but he was even better at managing his government. Now, he managed to burn his bridges with Labor after a very torrid time, and I probably should just take you through how that happened. The Scullin government won office in 1929 in a landslide. We had entered the Depression before, ahead of the world, by getting ourselves into a Greek problem. We had huge debts. We had debts in the 20s, state debts, federal debts. It was one of the reasons why Bruce brought together the Loan Council, to try and get on top of the problem of who was borrowing what. And it was all very well and good while we had very high wheat and wool prices. That was the mining industry of the 1920s. But when the prices for wool and wheat dropped in the 20s, our debt problem became enormous. And it's an irony to think that one of the gurus of spend and develop and spend you out of recession, John Maynard Keynes, was one of our loudest critics in London during the late 1920s for the fact that we were a spendthrift economy. Now, the Scullin Labor government had been in office, however, less than 2 years when it was obvious it had disintegrated from 29 to 31. We can appreciate the problems of a financial crisis much better now. Back in 1929, 30 and 31, it was seen much more as a labour against capital problem. And labour against capital had been the kind of debates going on right through the early part of the 20th century with the explosion of socialism in Europe and whatever. Its mounting debts led to huge divisions in caucus, but right through that period of time, the 1930-31 period, there was a huge credit squeeze at the same time. And so the issues of how to manage the economy went from what do we do about unemployment to, oh, but how do we keep good with our money lenders so that we don't have to sort of suddenly find money we can't pay? Where do we find the money to keep going? And as you can imagine, economists were trying to keep up with this sort of difficulty, and they didn't really have the answers. Lyons had come out of a strong Labor tradition in Tasmania. He had entered politics in 1909. He was seeped in Labor traditions. It was a very new Labor Party, but he was seeped in the Labor traditions of party record numbers and whatever. During the First World War, he had led the anti-conscriptionists and the leader of the Labor Party. They were in government in Tasmania in the early years of the First World War. He had led the anti-conscriptionists, but it had divided the Labor Party, as we know. Billy Hughes ended up moving to the Conservatives, the Labor leader, Labor Prime Minister. And after the first plebiscite, the Tasmanian Labor leader was forced out of the party, and Joe Lyons became the Labor leader and remained the Labor leader until he entered federal politics in 1929. Over the period of the 20s, Joe Lyons had been, he had toyed with more leftist positions. There was deep sectarianism after the First World War, sectarianism that impacted on Catholics especially. Lyons was of a Catholic background in a state which was not a very strongly, it was a strongly Protestant state, and the number of Catholics was very small in Tasmania. For that reason, he's no Santa Maria style Catholic. He doesn't believe in Catholic action in politics. In fact, he was opposed to the Catholic Federation for much of his early years as Labor leader, because he didn't believe that Catholics would benefit by acting outside of the political parties. He's a strong supporter of public education, for example. But in 1923, by 1923, after a succession of Labor losses at the state elections and a long period of Conservative government, there had been trouble in the Conservative side of politics with the formation of the Country Party. And the Conservatives could not get on top of the problem of Tasmanian debt. And right back from the beginning, while he was a Labor person and strong about the working man and all the rest of it, Lyons had become converted to the idea that unproductive government spending was a bad one, a bad idea. So this idea of getting on top of debt, making sure you could bring in surpluses wherever possible, not wasting government money, this became a kind of universal Joe Lyons position, backed by Lyndhurst Giblin, who was the economist that was mostly supporting Lyons right through his period as Premier and Prime Minister. In 1923, the loose coalition of Country Party and Nationalists in Tasmania founded. They lost votes on the floor of the House. The Lieutenant Governor called Lyons in late 23. He convinced the Lieutenant Governor he could form a government, and he became Premier of Tasmania, and he won a very handsome victory in 25 and was Premier until 28. So when he entered federal politics, that sort of background of sensible, pragmatic leadership was Joe Lyons' calling card. Now, during 1930, the Langites in caucus and the Conservative view of Scullin and Lyons and Theodore began to divide the whole caucus. Scullin was very sick when he left in August 1930 to go overseas for this long visit. Now, it was a folly in one sense. In another sense, no doubt he thought if he got to Britain, he could talk the money lenders into being kinder to Australia. There had been huge problems between the head of the Commonwealth Bank saying we had to be cautious in our money policy and Theodore, and then Theodore got himself into a mess over an inquiry in Queensland and had to step aside. As Scullin left, he handed the Treasury portfolio over to Joe Lyons. Jim Fenton became the Prime Minister, acting Prime Minister. And caucus became dysfunctional. Then there was the New South Wales election in October 1930. In the middle of all this, a financier was sent out by the British government by the name of Niemeyer to investigate Australia's financial condition. When he wasn't investigating Australia's financial condition, he was playing golf and writing in his diary how stupid we all were out here in the colonies. And he was recommending very tough financial drawdown or policies. Jack Lang won the 1930 New South Wales election, and then it was on for young and old. Lang's determination, because he had huge debts in New South Wales, and his determination to force the federal government to allow him to continue his expansive policies in New South Wales was forefront in his brain. So his selection of supporters, who were federal members, but they were backing Lang in New South Wales, they worked in caucus to push a much more left-wing policy. Lyons worked to keep the conventional advice of the what we would have called the Reserve Bank now of the day. And in his doing that, he was cabling Scullin, and Scullin was sending cables of support to keep hold the fort, hold the line. And so they came through a very torrid period. Denning wrote that you could hear the yelling in caucus through padded doors in Old Parliament House. Lyons at one point went home to Enid on, you know, train, ferry, you know, 2 days, 3 days out of Canberra. Everyone thought he was resigning. No, he was waiting for a cable from Scullin. High drama. Imagine what 24-hour TV news would have made of all that. So they got themselves through. In the middle of all this, there was a huge loan conversion that was, they had no one to lend the money that was needed to pay or to convert the loan. And Lyons became teamed up with some financiers led by Staniforth Ricketson of J.B. Weir & Son. Menzies, who is a very good friend of Staniforth Ricketson, Lyons had known Staniforth Ricketson back in Tasmania, so there was a sort of a personal connection. And they raised the money from ordinary Australians and financial companies over 6 weeks in November, December 1930. So if life was exciting now, life was very exciting in 1930. It was just hang on, hold on by the seat of your pants and keep going. And just before Christmas in 1930, they were advertising madly in the paper for people to sign up to this conversion, these conversion bonds. So on Scullin's return in 1931, he walks in after his nice cruise across the Pacific, and he's met by his heads of cabinet, and he comes into a situation which is boiling over. And there's a by-election coming for East Sydney, and the Langites look like they're going to win it. And Theodore, he's worried that Theodore is the only person who could fix the economy. And Theodore's saying we have to sort of get rid of this cautionary approach, and we have to go with the print the money idea and somewhere between, so we appease the Langites and we move on from conservative financial whatever. What happened then was that Lyons resigned from the ministry because he wouldn't accept that Theodore should be reinstated before he'd been cleared from the inquiry. He himself had stood Argyle aside down in Angus Ogilvie down aside in Tasmania in his own term as Premier. And then the fiduciary bill of printing money, eventually Lyons decided that he could not vote for it, and on the 13th of March made a huge speech in the House of Representatives and voted against that bill, along with five of his colleagues, which immediately put him outside the Labor Party. By the end of January, though, the Lang Labor people had been thrown out of caucus, so Labor was virtually split, and there was a virtual minority government for the rest of 1931. But how did Joe Lyons become a conservative? Now, when we talk about people power, we're hearing a little bit about it at the moment. Joe Lyons knew an awful lot about people power. He didn't plan it, but he just got to know it in 1931. And people power doesn't start from the top. You don't sort of stand at the top and say, come along, people, power me. People power comes from the bottom up. And what had been happening in the midst of this dysfunctionality that was in making the newspapers about what was happening in the Labor cabinet and caucus, people outside, the people who were bank clerks and tellers and people with small investments, small business owners, Stuart McIntyre said, the sort of fellows that had come home from the First World War, they were increasingly worried and they were increasingly alienated from mainstream politics. And across the southeast of Australia, small citizens groups that became huge citizen groups were mushrooming. And these citizens groups came into the hands of those conservative operatives around the Nationalist Party and at the head of them all was Keith Murdoch, who very carefully organised them into a growing tide of parapolitical operation. In April, Joe Lyons and Enid Lyons made a stunning trip across southeastern Australia, starting in Adelaide with Keith Murdoch having it all set up around his news media outlets, going across to Murray Bridge, taking the train across to Victoria, Melbourne, back up, finishing up in Sydney. These groups of thousands followed them along the way, attended meetings and gave the obvious impression that a groundswell of new blood was developing to sort of sweep the old politics aside and offer something new. And what Lyons thought he could do was a little bit what Ramsay MacDonald did that year in the UK, form a national government, a government that would pick up Labour people, nationalist people, country party people, and form a government of national emergency. But of course, that's not what happened. In fact, what happened was that in early May, the Nationalist Party convinced John Latham to step down as leader. Now, Joe Lyons wasn't a member of the Nationalist Party, so he wasn't in the room when he was elected leader. We think things are funny in politics today, because a new party was to be formed, but it hadn't been agreed. So in the Nationalist Party room, Joe Lyons was elected leader of the Conservatives, and shortly after, the United Australia Party was created, and he was a member of the United Australia Party with John Latham as his deputy. So you see, we've had these strange things in politics before. So he was this new leader. He was a Catholic leading the very Masonic and very Protestant Conservative Party of Australia, whatever you want to call it. And that's an aberration. That's something that you'd have to be my age at least to understand, or have read a lot of history. We might have divides now between all sorts of ethnic groups, or who supports left, who supports right, who's an atheist, who's a believer. But there was nothing quite like the sectarianism that really showed itself after the First World War, when people who had opposed conscription, who happened to have Dr. Mannix, the Catholic Archbishop of Melbourne, in their midst, and were many Labor supporters who had an Irish Catholic background, because Billy Hughes basically took the other sort of Labor with him. It was argued many times in late 1920, 1921, that Catholics were literally seditious, disloyal, were run from Rome, you know, things we wouldn't imagine now. So here we have this man who's been a pacifist, anti-conscriptionist in the First World War, or certainly an anti-conscriptionist, Catholic. He's got 10 children now. He was going to have 11 by the time he died, and he had 11 already because one had died at 10 months. Huge family, though people did have big families in those days. He's got this fairly active, involved wife who knows her place but also knows how to stand up on a podium and give a speech that's enough to excite male, female in an audience on whatever political issue of the day. And he's leading this party of conservatives who are deeply Masonic and Protestant. Now, it's obvious from the memories of people that many thought that Joe was going to be a very useful thing. He was going to bring a whole lot of disaffected Labor people over. And, of course, the election came faster than they imagined, because the government of Scullin fell over a minor matter of who was getting, what electorates were getting work relief and which weren't in Sydney, and the Lang Labor Group thought they were being left out, and they voted with the Conservatives, and Scullin decided to call an election in late November 1931. And of course, funnily enough, when you read the newspapers, you don't get a sense that Scullin had any idea just how far behind Labor was. Maybe they just didn't have Malcolm McKerris type analysis in those days. But the victory that the United Australia Party with the Citizens League of South Australia, because they were all basically connected, and the Country Party, the victory that they brought about for that House of Reps election only in 1931, 19th of December, has never been matched, not even by Malcolm Fraser in 1975. I know I've had a dispute with Michael Kroger in the pages of The Australian, but you have to add up all the forces, because this was a fluid time. And after that election, the UAP had so many seats that even though it had agreed to coalition with the Country Party, when the Country Party demanded the portfolio of trade and didn't get it, they didn't have to use the Country Party. So the UAP governed alone for the first Lyons government. That was a huge victory. But all of that is only the beginning of what I'll finish up very quickly now on just what happened with the Lyons years. We jump over those years and say, the only thing he ever did was set up the Commonwealth funding arrangements or whatever. No, we had huge change in the 30s. We had huge change in communications, and Lyons was a master at radio and eventually air travel. He was the first flying prime minister. People knew their prime minister like never before. They recognised him. A guy once who took him on a taxi to Mass at Albury when he was waiting for a train, he came back and said, "Oh, it was funny. The guy said to me, I look just like the prime minister." Because he was the prime minister. But people they knew what their prime ministers looked like they'd never before, because they saw them on movies, they saw them, they heard them on radio, and their voice and whatever. He managed the economy. First budget was a surplus. He managed the economy at a time of huge trials and tribulations. He kept unity among the UAP when they were full of jealous rivalries. When people kept calling for Bruce to come back, Bruce went off and became High Commissioner in London and was very useful in our foreign affairs. We made huge strides in foreign affairs. Lyons sent the Eastern Mission, headed by Latham in 1934, up through Indonesia, China, Japan, looking for trade routes, trying to dialogue with our neighbours. It was a huge period of instability, as you know, in foreign affairs. We played our role at two big imperial conferences in 35 and 37. Lyons with Enid went to Washington in 1935, met the senior members of the administration on favourable terms, stayed at the White House, got on very well with Roosevelt, and was able to tell Roosevelt that, unlike in the United States, where unemployment under the New Deal remained in double figures and in the 20s, right up until about 1937-38, and remained in the teens until the Second World War, when it was sucked up by the war spending, Australia got our unemployment down to about 16% in 1935 and was single digits by 1936-37. So in other words, the conservative, conventional advice of the day, and this happened also in the United Kingdom, served Australia well. The misinformation that's come out is that Australia had a worse depression than everyone else. In fact, we had a better depression than everyone else. And we got out of our unemployment problem, although not out of it totally, but we got out of the 29% and the 20% much faster than anyone in the Western world. Had we done what Lang wanted, which was to repudiate our debts, we would have ended up like Argentina, a pariah, unable to borrow money on the world markets. Lyons, I'll just quickly say, was very important in the abdication, because all the Dominion heads had to give consent to whatever the Prime Minister advised the King, and Lyons was the strongest advising against a morganatic marriage, and well, all the others except for Ireland were as one on that, but it was Lyons that was the strongest. And they didn't tell the King to abdicate, they just said they would not accept a marriage to Wallace Simpson. He was also very vital to the last Munich Agreement, and everyone's forgotten now that the Munich Agreement was hailed as a great success, but at the last minute, he cabled Chamberlain, whom he'd become to know very well, and said, "Why don't you try Mussolini?" He'd had a couple of meetings with Mussolini. Roosevelt thought Mussolini was pretty good stuff for Italy, actually, by the way. We've forgotten that as well. And they got a last meeting with Hitler. They had the signed Munich Agreement, the little piece of white paper, and the Queen wrote to Mrs. Chamberlain how proud she was of what her husband had done. But, of course, by the time Menzies resigned in March 1939 from the ministry, haggling over the national insurance, which had to be shelved. The Lyons government was very weak. Lyons himself was very weak. And by then, Hitler had invaded the rest of Czechoslovakia anyway. So the last Lyons year was a sad ending. And his death, of course, which was, he was mourned hugely. You see the documentaries of the people in the streets, you'd think it was a huge Anzac Day gathering in about 1952. And he was taken by, his body was taken down to Devonport by a destroyer and buried there. But that period of history, that is 8 years or so, should not be forgotten. It's a big story for Australia. And only in telling the Lyons story can you tell that story of Australia. So I hope everybody from now on just remembers to pop Joe Lyons back into the history books. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Anne. And you've whetted our appetites. Your book's actually on sale in the bookshop.
A bit over time, sorry.
No, plenty of time. There is time for questions if anyone would like to ask Anne a question about the things she's spoken of. I suppose that the chilling thing is how many echoes there are of present circumstances, mm-hmm. and how often we forget that adage that those who fail to learn from history are condemned to repeat its mistakes.
That's all true.
Yes.
And the other thing that Labor called... Lyons got on really well with Scullin in spite of... I mean, Scullin, I'll just this bit I didn't pop in, but Scullin sent that advice to Lyons and Fenton to hold the line through cables. When you read the history books, you think that everyone knew that, but no one knew that, not even some in the caucus. And what happened the day after Joe Lyons resigned or voted against his Labor treasurer and was automatically out of the Labor Party... Those cables were leaked. Joe Alexander was the journalist. He was banned from Parliament for about 6 months afterwards. They went off their faces in Parliament about it, the Scullin government. But what it showed was that Scullin had betrayed Lyons because he had let people think that it was Lyons that was holding the line against Lang without any support from his Prime Minister. And when Theodore wanted to go more inflationary and print money and all of that, and Scullin went with him, Scullin backed the wrong horse, because once those cables came out, it looked even worse that Scullin had not been loyal to his lieutenants. But Joe got on really well with Scullin. And when he was Prime Minister, they used to sit and have whiskey together in old Parliament House. He got on well with Chifley. There's a little anecdote which I think Crisp had in his biography of Chifley, where Joe, Prime Minister, turns up at the Bathurst show and Chifley's selling tickets to get into the car park or whatever. And they have a yarn at the gate. It was quite amusing, really. So, but Labor sort of went feral. But he was a truly strong Labor man, and I think it broke his heart to leave.
If anyone does have a question, would you like to go to the microphone? Yes.
Well, thank you for a very interesting talk. You filled in a lot of gaps for me, thanks. You mentioned during your talk that a British financier named Niemeyer came out to Australia, and my recollection of that was that his advice was rather counter-Keynesian at a time when we wanted to lift things. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on Lyon's relationship with Niemeyer and how he handled his advice and how that fell out.
I deal with that a bit in because there's a lovely Niemeyer diaries, which are fascinating. Keynes changed. Everyone's forgotten this, as did a lot of economists. when Keynes was berating Australia in 1927 or whenever it was for being a spendthrift, he was berating Australia for doing exactly what he would have argued 10 years later. Roosevelt had a meeting with Keynes halfway through the New Deal and didn't find him very inspiring. It's quite funny. Amity Slay's got a wonderful story about that in her book. I think it's called The Forgotten People, I can't remember. But look, myths just multiply when you don't listen to the minutiae of history. And Keynes changed. And it's been fashionable to go on with this notion that we can spend our way. Now, spending and trying to give people relief is a good thing. But it isn't a good thing if at the end you're only giving relief and you're not getting anything back for it, because eventually you do end up like Greece and eventually you do end up like Portugal. And at the moment, funny money is going to keep them limping along for a while, but the funny money will probably over a period of a decade give us all very low growth. So maybe we'll settle for low growth and no one starving. I don't know. But it certainly isn't a magic formula. What Lyons and the conventional people of the day were, this is, remember 31, there was almost no credit and everyone was living off loans. So if you don't have credit, you're in Queer Street. This is Greece now. If you don't get anyone to back you for all the schemes that you've got, you've promised people you're going to pay them here and pay them there and who's going to pay the public service, whatever. We were paying out something like 75% of our outlays were already designated before we even got anything in. We probably mostly in loans. We had to find a way to get through 30. 1930 was a credit squeeze. Now Niemeyer comes out and there's all sorts of argy-bargy going on. if you read Staniforth Ricketson's diaries, you know that Theodore knows he's coming, you know the Australian government knows he's coming, but it's made to look like Gibson, you know, didn't know he was coming. It was all sprung on us, but in fact it was all set up and he was coming out. He makes out he's an independent investigator, but in fact it's all been worked on. But we didn't have a lot of choice but to accept him, because most of our loans and most of our money was dependent on the London bankers. And so he came out, and look, he wasn't a bad man or anything else. But, of course, people like Anstey and Lang assumed he was a Jew and did a whole lot of anti-Semitic statements about him, which was disastrous, horrible. He was of the usual insouciant UK coming to the colonies kind of guy. He was nice and affable and pleasant. But in his diary he writes, you know, one-liner, he dismisses people with one line, whether it's Lyndhurst Giblin or Fenton and Lyons or whatever. And at one point he said Fenton and Lyons looked like rabbits with their eyes popping out in the light. Well, I explain how that wouldn't be surprising, because they were doing Scullin's work at these meetings. He was meeting like a premier's meeting. He was meeting all the heads of government and trying to work out what could be done with Australia and whether we deserved any more credit and whatever, and how we could better, just like Greece now. He was working out a plan how we could take the austerity, prove that we'd be reliable creditors, customers, and then be deserving of more credit. So in other words, he was doing what the Europeans and the International Money Fund and everyone else is doing to Greece now, saying, we'll say you're okay, we'll keep your rating, your credit rating and all that stuff, provided you agree to cut public servant salaries or at least freeze them, cut MP salaries, freeze the public service spending, whatever. So there was a program of austerity being worked out so we would be able to continue to get credit. And shortly after that we had the conversion where we had to raise all the money from ordinary Australians. So Nijmeyer was writing this diary, dismisses people, but in fact, if you think about it, he's here in August, Scullin's leaving in August for his trip overseas, he's got the flu, maybe pleurisy, I don't know, but he's in bed. Some of the cabinet meetings were conducted in his bedroom in Richmond in Melbourne. He was still in his bed on the high seas as he went towards England, so he was a sick, sick man taking off with a sick, sick economy, with a dysfunctional caucus and an explosive cabinet, and he's left his stand-ins, and his treasurer has been stood aside because he's under investigation in Queensland which the Labor Party said was mocked up to embarrass the Labor Party, but whatever it was, he's had to stand aside. And Fenton and Lyons are running back to Yarra Street or wherever it was in Richmond and getting Scullin's approval, then running back to Nijmeyer and saying this is what the Prime Minister will agree to, and then he'd be told by Nijmeyer what they'd agree to, and then they'd run back to Scullin. It was a madhouse, mad. So no wonder their eyes looked like rabbits staring at a bright light. I mean, they didn't know which way they were allowed to go. And this gives the image. These are the sort of little snippets that have given the image that Fenton and Lyons were weak. They weren't weak. They were just trying to juggle it. Then if you read the diaries and if you read the way in which Lyons is trying to navigate this nasty piece of business, at one point Lyons says to Nijmeyer, it would be better if it didn't look like we are simply adopting your proposals. Because he knew that if that were to be the impression given, back in caucus, the Langites and their fringe dwellers like John Curtin and others would go off their faces and just refuse to go along with it. The party would split. So he's trying to say to this insouciant dandy from London, for goodness sake, if you want to get what you want, then leave me handle the politics of it, because you're not going to get anywhere if you alienate my colleagues. But of course, Nijmeyer wants to be the big man. And, you know, you can understand a little bit of hesitancy and shift. And, of course, Nijmeyer sees this as weakness. In fact, it was strong political common sense trying. But Nijmeyer didn't have to worry. He went off and visited the homes of the rich squatocracy. Then he went to New Zealand. He played golf and he wrote about it. And he left Australia a day after Lang won the New South Wales election, which was very symbolic. Sorry? He left Australia on a ship. I think he was heading for America, the day after Lang, or the day 2 days after Lang won the New South Wales election. So he sort of walked out, left us with it.
The question was, what was his handicap?
His handicap? Now, he didn't tell us that, and it wouldn't make any sense to me. But he had some very good golf. But you can get the tenor, you can get the feeling of it. It's And I'm sure there are many politicians, ministers have had experiences similar where someone is out there investigating or giving you advice or doesn't have to face the people. They're telling you what must be done, whether it's the head of the Reserve Bank or whatever, and you're saying, yeah, but what can be done? It's not easy.
John?
Thank you very much for your lecture. You reflected on his relationship with Chifley there in a nice vignette. What was his relation like with the rest of his former Labor colleagues
in
Good Parliament
question.
For his prime ministership?
Mm. Well, see, in Tasmania, he went back after he left the party or was banned or whatever, and it was really chilling down in Hobart. They were for him. They were at him. He left a meeting early. They voted him. They voted, you know, to discipline him. But of course he was gone then anyway. Damien had said that I can't remember the name of the Labor MP in Tasmania. I can't remember either. I think he was a state Labor MP. He used to always come and see him at Christmas, but he would never let anyone know that he came to see him at Christmas. Mary, I'm trying to think of the name, very good member of the Labor Party, very big local family in... Launceston, I'll think of her name in a moment. They were a big, wealthy family. Her family was the Sullivans, but she married a political family. I'll think of their name in a moment. She said that it was devastating to the Labor followers of Joe because they'd given lots of money to his cause. But then it divided as well. Many ordinary people supported him, and he did win his seat as a Labor man. As a Conservative, he won that seat, having been a Labor man. So he won Wilmot again and he'd gone from one side to the other. So he had a personal following. But he was, Enid Lyons writes about the day after he gave the speech at Spencer Street Railway Station, woman who was the wife of a very senior Labor figure just cut her dead on the platform. It was visceral, you know. And so the fact that he yarned away with Scullin in Parliament House over a whiskey was interesting. And Scullin, in one of his letters to Enid, he said, it would have been about 36, 37, he said, you'd be stunned at how sectarian it is at Trades Labor Hall down in Melbourne. So there was a lot of sectarianism in the Labor Party, and I guess Scullin found a partner with another Catholic who could understand him. But it wasn't good, and he had good relations. People say he never fitted in with the Conservatives. He had lots of good relationships. He was very friendly with Menzies. He was, you know, he had what's his name? Gullett was a good pal. But then he fell out politically with a lot of them at the end because, but in the end, everyone felt they could do it better, but no one could get the numbers to win the leadership, and they were all fighting one another, and war was coming, and no one really knew what they were doing. But they were rearming. There's been a very good book done. Andrew Ross, I think, is the name. He's a public servant, but he did a very good book called Armed and Ready that showed we were spending much more on defence after about 35, 36, as the UK did once Baldwin came in, and Chamberlain came in. And so, but the last, that national insurance split the party, it was a really good scheme to have a national insurance scheme, but at the wrong time. Everyone was asking for money for armaments, for defence. And Menzies and Enid Lyons are interesting because she saw him as acting disloyally in the very last months of his Lyons' life. After a speech he gave, I think it was October or September 1938, to the Constitutional Association in Sydney. It wasn't recorded, so no one can actually pick it apart. But in that speech he was reported to have said that Australian leadership was weak, and he meant state and federal, and that what we needed was to take some example from the strong leaders of Europe, by whom he meant Mussolini and Hitler. And it was... Kristallnacht did come only a couple of months later, but... and Munich was around that time. But... it was a silly speech, but why, when you go through where he'd been and what had happened, there'd been a Premier's meeting, Lyons had been ill, Earl Page, the Country Party man, had taken over, people didn't like Earl Page, they saw the Country Party as meddling in the United Australia Party's affairs. Stevens, the New South Wales Premier, Conservative New South Wales Premier, was hoping to get a seat and come in and take over from Lyons. There was a lot of jostling going on as to who was setting themselves up for the heir apparent. Menzies probably made the speech to get the limelight back on him, strong leader, goofed over that. It didn't go down well. There was a big argument. So Enid Lyons interpreted that speech as a shot across Joe's bows. Menzies always said it wasn't. It was just the way he felt. Then there was, of course, the strike in Newcastle in the new year, and where Bob Menzies got the title Pig Iron Bob, trying to end the strike to ship pig iron to Japan. He handled that badly. Stevens looked much more like the person, but he didn't have a seat. Lyons had been wanting to retire for that final year. He was very sick, or in the sense his health was bad, but he did front up to enormous amounts of party meetings, ministries meetings, whatever. Enid had gone down to prepare the house for the children to come back and live there. Most of them were at boarding school, but the little ones were in the lodge. Then she took them down that last year to live in Devonport with home help, older children looking after them, whatever. So the alliance couple were ready to go, but the National Union, as it was called, the headquarters of the United Australia Party, were not enamoured by the idea that Menzies could win the election, which was due the end of 1940, that he was unpopular, he was too erudite and austere. They didn't have another alternative candidate. People say that Charles Hawker, in the middle of everything, dreadful parliamentary debates where Curtin's going to bring on a motion of no confidence and whatever, they get news that a plane's crashed in Dandenong and Charles Hawker, one of their senior UAP figures, has been on the plane and he's died. So, I mean, there's everything going wrong. And so he's gone. He was seen as leadership material. I'm not so sure he was. And then in the midst of all this, Menzies in March resigns from the ministry, says it's over the national insurance. And Leonard, in her memoir Among the Carrion Crows, that came from the saying from Billy Hughes that said she was a bird of paradise among the carrion crows when she won a seat in the House of Representatives. Something silly Billy would say. But she used a whole section of that, a chapter, to say what she felt had happened over that period from the constitutional speech, what she read in the newspapers, her telling Joe that Menzies had been acting against him and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of ill feeling then. And when Joe died so soon after Menzies' resignation, it's a matter of weeks, it was the weekend after the UAP heavies had told Leonard and Joe he must stay on, and he'd said he would. And it was felt by some of the Lyons family that the pressure that Menzies had exerted on him in those last months had added to the possibility that he would have a heart attack and die. Many say it might have happened anyway, and the pressure was there, whether it was Menzies or someone else. There was pressure from everyone. He probably could have retired or should have retired in June the year before, and then he would have possibly had a more comfortable retirement. But as it was, he died in office, and there was a lot of bit of feeling. Now, of course, you probably all know the story, or some of you do, of what happened after his death. Earl Page assumed the caretaker prime ministership or whatever and made a speech in the House of Parliament, in the House of Representatives, against Menzies, which got, I think it got slightly edited, but was reported. And he accused Menzies of being a coward in the First World War, not going to signing up for the war effort. And, of course, the true story is that Menzies was the third brother and the family had said he was not to go. And Paddy Menzies, I was told by Heather Henderson, never spoke to Earl Page again. And she actually got through a whole dinner one night at some big function where she had to sit next to Page and she didn't utter one word to him. That's Paddy Menzies. But, you know, that kind of festering feeling didn't help the conservative side of politics either. Earl Page eventually was forced to resign within a year, and it didn't do him any good either. There was a huge debate over Enid Lyons' annuity. The Labor Party cut the amount down hugely and didn't even want her to get one. She had no superannuation. Joe died with £340 or something in the bank. She'd always had the house in her name, and she, being herself, thought she could earn money herself. But of course, her nerves got the better of her and she had to retire by the end of the year. She did some broadcasting that first year. She had been asked to do a column for the Sydney Morning Herald. But she did eventually get an annuity of £500 a year and something like that for the children, but it diminished as they left school. And she still had about 8 children to finish school and one hadn't started. And Elsie Curtin was given a similar annuity, but only after, Enid Lyon says, she prevailed on the UAP party room or the Liberal Party room, it would have been the Liberal Party room then, not to do to Elsie Curtin what the Labor Party had done to her. And so when it went through Parliament, she said she had tears in her eyes. But when, by the time of John Gorton's prime ministership, those two women had this tiny pension, and they were in poverty compared with widows of MPs who had superannuation, as it had been for some years by then. And there was there's correspondence in the files from others petitioning John Gorton to do something about these two women's annuity because they don't have enough to live on. Because it hadn't changed ever since the 40s and 1939. So, you know, interesting times then.
on that sad note, I think that we've probably reached the end of our time, but you've charmed us. You've given us lots of insights into times past and a few reflections on times present as well. So please join me in thanking Andy Henderson for today's lecture.